I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne, and welcome to The Connection. Today's program is about sex trafficking and abuse and may not be suitable for all listeners, but it's a necessary one because of the magnitude of the problem. The horrific sex crimes of Jeffrey Epstein and the cover-ups took place under five different presidents. These crimes have been politicized. They've become the subject of lawsuits and news stories, of exposés, books, podcasts, and documentaries. And yet, there are so many unanswered questions. Joining us are psychologists Annie Farmer and Liz Stein, an anti-trafficking activist. They both spoke at a news conference in September, along with others, about how this sex abuse by Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and others hurt them. Their courage and pressure and calls for accountability led to the Epstein Files Transparency Act, meaning those DOJ files are supposed to be released by December 19th, and that is next Friday. We invited our guests to help us understand sex predators, their enablers and accomplices, victims and survivors, and a system that favored criminals along with the rich and well-connected. Sex crimes are common. Here's a hotline number if you or someone you know needs help. It's the National Sexual Assault Hotline, and it's 1-888-656-4673. Annie Farmer, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Liz Stein, who's here with us in our Philadelphia studios, thanks for having you on The Connection as well.
Thank you for having me.
And let me say to our listeners that this is not an easy conversation for our guests to have, but they agreed to join us because it is so important to educate all of us about sex abuse, because there is so much shame and there's so much secrecy and so much misinformation. Annie, let me start with you, and even looking over the last couple of months, that news conference that you had in September, and then in November, the signing of the Transparency Act. Does it feel like a victory at all after all these years?
It does. You know, I think that especially this most recent trip to D.C. and what we saw happen there in Congress, I think for many of us, it felt like we felt proud about seeing something that so many people said would never happen, right? That they, at least that this law was passed and there's now this demand for accountability. We'll see what happens with that, what they do with that, but that is a victory. And I think it's important that we celebrate those along the way.
Indeed. Liz, what has this been like for you the last couple of months?
It's been really overwhelming. And I think that, like Annie said, it's so important for us to celebrate the victories that we have, but we also need to stay constant with the realization that there are a lot more battles ahead of us. But we have been able to do things that people never thought we would be able to do. And that's happened because we've come together. And, you know, our voices collectively are hard to ignore. And that's intentional on our part.
Before September 3rd, had you met Annie Farmer?
I had met Annie at the sentencing of Ghislaine Maxwell, but only very briefly. But another really wonderful thing that's come out of all of this advocacy is that we are making friendships with each other. We're getting to know each other, and it's wonderful to have a group of women who've had the same experience who can understand how emotionally laden it is without having to constantly re-explain what happened.
Because you know,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you're nodding your head, Annie.
Yeah, yeah. I think it has been a silver lining in this very challenging saga has been the relationships we've formed. And there is just a sense of, I think, understanding and appreciation for each other.
I mean,
that's
was
kind
it?
Of unique.
Yes. And going back to you, Annie, I mean, this is something that happened back in 1996. It involved you and your sister.
Yes.
This was something that you had to really carry what felt like almost by yourself, the two of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really, you know, coming together in New York in 2019 after Epstein's death that I first met other survivors outside of just my sister. Right. And of course, we knew that they existed, but we had no way of getting in touch with each other. And so I think to hear so many stories that had these common themes and just to see people in person and understand the way that lives had been devastated by this criminal, you know, group, it really, it was very emotional, but it was also really incredible.
How lonely had it been, Liz, before you met your soldier sisters or your solidarity sisters?
I did not realize that I had been trafficked until Epstein was arrested in 2019. And when he was arrested, I thought that, you know, prior to that, I thought that I was the only one that this happened to. And so there were a lot of emotions tied up when I realized that not only was I not the only one, but that there were, you know, from our government's own admission, 1,000 survivors of this crime. And so I, for a long time, felt very, very alone with it. And that is part of what really made me feel strongly about attending Maxwell's trial in New York every day. I needed to feel some kind of connection to the other people that were harmed by them.
Annie, what was it like to be at her trial, Ghislaine Maxwell's trial?
Yeah, the trial was one of the more stressful experiences of my life, to be honest. You know, I think that part of it was knowing that while there were only four of us that were able to testify, we represented, you know, such a larger group. And so I think my sense of just wanting to, you know, to be as powerful a witness as I could be on behalf of everyone, I think, you know, it felt like a lot of pressure, but it also, you know, was this opportunity to actually confront this person and have people hear about the way that she operated and the way she not only was a part of finding victims for Epstein, but also participated in the abuse. I think that was a really important thing that came out of the trial. Knowing that she was sentenced, it felt like this sense, again, a victory and a sense of finally some sense of justice. But of course, that has also been challenged with everything that's happened over the summer.
And I do want to talk to that, but going back to you, Annie, were you able to look at her?
I did. Yes, I actually was sort of in conversation with a survivor, a Lakota woman who had talked about sort of the importance in her culture of making eye contact as mm-hmm. a way of asserting power, right? And so when she, I talked to her prior to me going to New York, and she was like, yeah, I really encourage you to try and look at her, right? and I thought that was really interesting, because of course it is very natural to want to just avoid someone like that. But ultimately, you know, she wouldn't make eye contact with me.
But what did you see when you looked at her?
I saw someone that, of course, you know, so much older. All of us, this was so much, you know, this happened in 1996, as you said. So the trial, you know, was over 20 years later. And so I just, you know, it was strange to see someone that had done all this, who was still completely unable to take any accountability, and was now, you know, a woman in, I guess, maybe her 60s, and still just completely unable to be honest about what had happened.
And what was it like for you, Liz, to be in that courtroom?
Well, it was interesting. I will never forget the first day that I was in the actual courtroom during the trial, and I had to be in the same room with her. And that was like I had a very visceral whole body response. But by the time we got to the sentencing, I knew how important it was for me to read a victim impact statement and to not mince words about what happened to me. I was very honest about what my life looked like in the aftermath and how it affected me. And I very intentionally turned to look at her while I was delivering the victim impact statement. And it was important for me when I got up there and I addressed the court. There was a reporter who commented on how I nearly shouted as I addressed the courtroom, and that was intentional. I wanted my entire voice to fill up that room, and I wanted everyone in there to be unable to avoid what I was saying. And to what Annie just said, you know, that gave me a sense of power and reclaiming that was really important for me.
Did it feel like healing? Maybe not entirely healing, but did it feel like a healing thing to do for yourself?
I think that it definitely felt healing for me to finally stand up to someone who had victimized me and hurt me so badly, and to do it publicly and to do it in a way that I felt empowered instead of, you know, all of those horrible feelings that I felt for so many years, like I had no power.
Let me go back to you, Annie, because as you mentioned, over the summer, Ghislaine Maxwell was moved to a minimum security prison. She has what sounds like many freedoms, even the people and women at the prison do not have. She was interviewed by a member of the Trump administration, a former private or personal lawyer for President Trump. And people that have been found guilty of sex crimes are not sent to minimum security prisons. What is the message you think of that decision to move her?
Yeah, I think it was extremely troubling to watch that unfold. There is no communication of any kind to us as victims about, you know, what was occurring or why it was occurring. Once the transcript was released of that interview with Todd Blanche, it was very clear that she was not pressed in any way, that she was just given the opportunity and platform to continue to lie. And this is someone that the government, our government, had charged, you know, with perjury.
Right.
And so it was, I think that for most people watching that, it felt like, okay, why is this happening? Right. And it just seems, of course, that there must be there's something happening behind the scenes that would lead to this type of preferential treatment. And it is bothersome to hear about like these special privileges and to learn that other women in this facility are actually being punished, you know, for speaking out about her being there. To me, that was just especially an upsetting aspect.
Liz, I mean, do you think there's a message to Epstein's and Ghislaine Maxwell's survivors, a message about her treatment?
I think that it shows us as survivors how fragile justice is, right? How fragile justice is for us in this case. To have someone who was tried, convicted, and sentenced for the crime of sex trafficking, to be given this leniency, I think that if it was any other person in the world, if it was someone who didn't have a famous name and wasn't tied to a notorious case, I don't think any of us would be able to stand for what's been going on. And so it's particularly upsetting and troubling to us why she's getting any kind of preferential treatment whatsoever. It's definitely something for us all to think about.
Indeed. Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Liz Stein, also with us Annie Farmer. They are survivors of Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell's sex abuse and trafficking, much in the news, of course, these days. And we're very lucky that they're willing to give us time to talk about what happened to them, but also to help us understand what sex trafficking is all about, what sex abuse is all about, something that's really been covered in silence for so long. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Liz Stein and Annie Farmer. Liz Stein is a survivor leader, I should say, in the national anti-trafficking movement. Also, Annie Farmer is a licensed psychologist providing therapy and assessment for individuals and couples. And they have been talking about their various experiences and overcoming some of the trauma of being sex trafficked and abused sexually by Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and others. Annie, let me go back to you because, you know, this language is so tricky and so important. What's the difference between being a survivor and a victim?
Oh, it's a great question. You know, I use both terms, and I think sometimes the context is what makes that distinction, right? I think that some people really prefer the term survivor because it focuses on the fact that this is, you know, that we've moved on, right? Beyond, we are more than these crimes and we've moved on beyond them. I also think that there's times when actually it can be really difficult to acknowledge what's happened to you, and coming to terms with the victim aspect of the experience can be really painful. And so sometimes it also, I think, is important to use that term to know that, yeah, someone else chose to do something to me, committed a crime against me. And in that regard, I was a victim, right? But I'd be curious to hear, you know, Liz's perspective on it, but that's
sure.
kind of how I think about it.
Yeah, and I'm looking at Liz right now. Go ahead.
So I work with other survivors of sex trafficking, and I talk about this a lot. I like to think of it as a trajectory, right? We identify as victims, then we identify as survivors, and then we want to be seen as thrivers, right? People who have been able to overcome what's happened to us. And to Annie's point, I think that it depends on the context that you're using, because we are victims of a crime. But sometimes the word victim can feel disempowering. And so it's really important to understand that it's kind of there's stages of recovery that you move through and identify with. I would definitely have identified myself as a victim in the mm-hmm. 90s when this happened to me, but I now identify myself as a survivor, unless it's in a legal context, and then, you know, I identify as a victim.
And yes, and again, the language is so important. Any going back to you, and I don't think there's anything new about this, and I wonder whether we've even made progress in understanding that when someone is, let's say, a victim of a sex crime, so often, you know, the victims are the women in this case, we're talking about women here, are questioned and their motives are put under a microscope. And if they misspeak here, that is held against them. Have we made progress when it comes to, you know, if not just believing victims, but at least understanding their struggles as they try to tell their story?
I hope so. I do think that there's a way in which when it comes to these issues, there's a cycling that happens, you know, where there's maybe more awareness that grows and more acceptance, and then often a backlash, mm-hmm. right? And I think that that's true with, like, just acknowledging the crimes of child sexual abuse and exploitation more generally, and then and with all crimes of a sexual nature, right? It's like, I think it's hard for people to wrap their head around these things sometimes because of the pain associated with them. And that can make people want to dismiss. And one way that we dismiss, right, is by blaming victims, blaming survivors, just sort of focusing on factors, vulnerability factors, versus actually the decisions that the perpetrators made to harm them, right? So we've seen a lot of the old playbook come up in this case for sure, but I hope that so many individuals, so many women telling their stories helps people to see beyond that.
And Liz, you mentioned this earlier, which is that you didn't realize until Jeffrey Epstein was actually arrested that you had been trafficked. Help us understand perhaps the kind of thinking, or perhaps even the change of thinking that you went through when realizing what had happened to you, whereas before it wasn't kind of part of your reality.
No, it wasn't. The way that this has played over and over and over in my mind for decades now was that I was an ambitious college student. I really had my eyes on a professional career. I had met these people who were my friends, and I use that term very loosely.
This but would be Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey.
Ghislaine and Jeffrey, who were my friends. And there were a lot of complicated emotions wrapped up into that because of the grooming and the gaslighting. But the way that it was in my mind was this was a group of friends that I had no business being involved with. And the things that happened during my involvement with them were things that I never, ever, ever wanted to think about or talk about or tell anyone. I didn't even know how to describe a
lot of
what
happened. You didn't have the words?
I didn't have the words. And I say that a lot. I didn't have the words and still don't have the words to describe a lot of what happened to me. And so I'll never forget, I was sitting at a friend's kitchen table when I saw that Epstein had been arrested, and my mouth nearly hit the floor. And I was very confused because I was, you know, we were hearing about the young women in Florida. and we were hearing about the island. And I was in my mind thinking, but I was their friend. They didn't traffic me, but I wasn't on the island, but I wasn't underage, but I wasn't in Florida. Well, I was in Florida with them, but I wasn't, you know, a young girl in Florida. And so this, you know, this, what happened to me was different than what they're talking about. And the media just kept talking about trafficking, trafficking, trafficking. And they were telling me that I had been trafficked, but they didn't tell me what trafficking was. And so I really immersed myself in the anti-trafficking movement and learned everything that I could about trafficking, and came to realize that it was exactly what had happened to me. And to have a term, to have a word, to have an understanding for what was done to me was so liberating, because I carried the shame and the guilt of this for decades.
And I'm assuming the secrecy as well.
Absolutely.
Right?
I hadn't told anyone. And there was also that terror of, who can I tell? Who can I trust? What's going to happen? You know, I endured being followed. I endured being pursued. And those fears come back to you. You know, you just don't know who you can trust.
I'm really sorry that happened to you. If you don't mind, I'd like to just talk to you a little bit about what happened, because I think it helps us put into context what we need to know and, frankly, what we can do about it. You were 16 years old when you first met Jeffrey Epstein. This was in 1996. In fact, it was your sister who introduced you to him. How did that grooming start? How did he sort of pull you into his net?
Yeah, well, and I think it's helpful to, you know, hear different from different survivors, because people had different experiences, right? And I think that illustrates, you know, the kind of the ways that they operated. It wasn't always the same playbook. In my case, my sister Maria had she was a graduate student in New York. She had a very promising art career, and was introduced by the dean of her art school to Epstein and Maxwell at an art event. And it was sort of encouraged for her to sell them work, because these are good people to know, good people for our community, right? From that, she was hired to procure art for him, and help. She had, well, of
sister.
Course, a lot of connections with young artists.
Yeah.
And so it was in the context of her work then that he sort of asked her about her family and learned about me. I was 10 years younger, a high school student, kind of starting to think forward towards college. And she, you know, was talking about all of that. And he, you know, very generously seemingly said, you know, oh, well, this is what I do. I like to help people with their education. I'd really like to meet your sister and talk to her about, you know, her path. And so he flew me to New York. And that was where I first met him, at his mansion. So the grooming in my case, you know, it was very much, I think, really playbook kind of grooming, right? Special attention, right? I was made to feel very special. They bought us tickets to go to a Broadway show. I think they sent a limousine with a driver, right? So it was very much like, wow, I'm getting this special treatment. This person must really care about me, care about my future. He did engage with me in conversations about, you know, where I should consider going to school and how I could improve my application. And then from that, then there was the first kind of signs that it was more than that, right? Him holding my hand and rubbing my leg when we went to the movies, and very brazenly doing this when my sister was present, but seated in such a way that she couldn't see what was happening, right? And so it's these kind of things that make you question yourself, I think, as a young person, when you don't have a context for understanding this kind of behavior, because it's like, well, surely he wouldn't do something like that, that if it was inappropriate, if he did have a romantic or, you know, sexual interest, he wouldn't do that right here in this public space where my sister could potentially see it. So I think that was how the grooming started for me.
I mean, it sounds like what is really disturbing as sort of gets normalized, but it seems like he also, and perhaps with both of you, understood your vulnerability, sort of what you needed, what you wanted, and was able, and you're nodding there, Annie.
Yeah.
And well, I'll get to you, Liz, as well, but sort of understood how to play off, if not your weaknesses, your vulnerabilities, your needs.
Yeah, I think that is really common amongst predators, is being very savvy about detecting what someone's needs are and telling them a story about how they can help fill in the blanks, right? So in this case, for me, there is, my father was fairly absent from my life at this point. There was a concern about finances and a worry on my part about putting additional stress on my mom with college tuition. And so I thought, and I was naive, right, to this process because I was still a high school student. So I didn't even really fully understand how things like financial aid worked, right? But this story of I can step in and help you with this, was a very compelling one.
Was that true for you, as Liz, as well? Sort of, and perhaps, as you said, you felt like you were almost friends, so you were part of this group of what felt like very, what, fast-moving people?
Yeah, definitely.
Exciting, right? Or weird, I mean, at the moment.
They were. There's definitely duality, right? Because what our perception might have been at the time and what reality was two very different things.
Yes.
I definitely, from the first time that I met Ghislaine Maxwell, she honed right in on what my vulnerabilities were. Conversations about my family, my upbringing, what life was like for me at home, what my ambitions were for the future. I was a senior in college when I first met them, and I wanted to go to law school. And so they had connections. And, at the time I was working in the fashion industry, and I knew better than to upset them because of the people that they knew. And I was ambitious. I wanted to have a future where I was prosperous and, where I was recognized professionally. And I thought that they earnestly wanted to help me to have the career that I wanted. And so I trusted them when I shouldn't have.
And that's Liz Stein, who joins us along with Annie Farmer. And you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Annie, back to you. And I just want to sort of complete, I guess, this really difficult chapter in both of your lives. And I know you were taken or sent to his New Mexico ranch or whatever that was. And all of a sudden, the foot rubs turned into what sounded like sexual assault. It must have been absolutely terrifying.
I think really that there was this sort of gradual breaking down of boundaries even over the course of just that one weekend that I spent with them, and as you said, yeah, here, Ghislaine starting by, let me show you how to rub Jeffrey's feet, right? And then, oh, wouldn't you like a massage? And let me show you, what that's like. And you should, take your clothes off. That's how massages work. And to, Epstein crawling into bed with me. And, I think at that point, I had more and more difficulty sort of explaining away their behavior, right? And a sense of just like a pit in my stomach dread. But also very much focused on maintaining a sense of normalcy in terms of my behavior and dismissing this because it didn't feel like there was a lot of options there. And so, yeah, my response, to him getting into bed with me was, trying to make this excuse of, oh, I need to use the restroom, right? Because that felt like that was something that I could, do without making a fuss, right? And then, trying to kind of bide my time because it felt like I know this will be over soon and hopefully we can just forget about it, move on, right? But I think that hearing from other people, in my case, I never had to see them again after that, right? And unfortunately, other people, for all different kinds of reasons, had to stay in their orbit for long periods of time. And so I've heard now more from women about how that behavior progressed.
We know about fight and flight. Those are two responses. But we're learning that there's this freeze response. And we're also learning there's this fawn response. In fact, we just did a show about fawning a couple of months ago. The idea is that you try to ingratiate yourself with someone as a way to protect yourself. Can you speak to that at all, Liz? I mean, this sort of, you know, what you do when you feel you're terrified, sometimes we fight, sometimes we run, but sometimes we freeze and sometimes we fawn.
I think that people just assume that when you're being assaulted, you're going to do everything that you can to fight back.
Right.
And you may want to fight back, you know, when you think about if this something like this would ever happen to you. I'm sure that that's the first thing that you think is going to happen. But it's generally not what happens. And what is going on in the moment is so incredibly emotionally overwhelming that it is almost impossible to process. And so your nervous system just kind of kicks in and your brain shuts off. And so that's something that we see survivors are questioned about a lot. You know, why did you freeze? Why did you do something to ingratiate yourself to someone? It's because all of the alarm bells are going off inside of you, and you know that you are in a horribly threatening situation, and you don't want to make it any worse than it already is. And so you don't want to upset the people that are, you know, the people that are trying to, you know, perpetrate crimes against you. And you're doing your best in the moment with limited capacity because your brain is shut off to really just protect yourself in the moment. And, you know, it's a really common response to do things like Annie says that, you know, she needed to go to the restroom. That is a palatable excuse. For me, I used that I was going to be sick to my stomach. And you find these little ways to placate the people that are hurting you because you know that if you don't, it's just going to get worse.
I mean, it must be absolutely terrifying.
It is.
Can I say something? Yeah,
Annie, if you can just hold on, only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again, talking with Liz Stein and Annie Farmer. And we've been talking about what happened to them by Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and others as well. Much more after a short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and just to recap, here for decades, survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse suffered in silence, but now they are speaking out. And today on the show, our guests are Liz Stein and Annie Farmer, and we've been discussing the psychology of grooming and trauma and power and healing. And again, Annie Farmer is a licensed psychologist providing therapy and assessment for individuals and couples. Liz Stein is a survivor leader in the National Anti-Trafficking Movement. And Annie, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on to this piece about the different responses, right? The not only fight, flight, but also freeze and fawn. Because in my work with survivors of all kinds of sexual abuse and sexual assault, I just see that there still continues to be so much self-blame. And I think a lot of it goes back to these responses, right? And this idea that, you know, either what was wrong with me, that I didn't do something else, that I quote unquote allowed this to happen to me, or even that, you know, I continued to talk to this person, or I continued to try and placate them in some way, more of the fawning kind of behavior. And I think sometimes I point out to people that actually, you know, some research would suggest your chances of survival are actually greater, right? If you are not
compliant
back in that context, right? And that I think it's actually quite instinctual that we, you know, sometimes we understand what we need to do to survive is that, right? But then what can happen, right, is that there is this additional sense of self-betrayal sometimes that we have to work through. And I think it's also, you know, all the cultural messages we've received that we've absorbed about these crimes, right? And so I just think that this is where conversation, normalizing is so key to letting go of that and moving beyond that. And why I think, you know, why Liz and I are compelled to have these kind of conversations, right? It's just to help people understand that they're not alone, no matter what. You know, this case has gotten a lot of attention, of course, because of the names of people involved. But I think there's so many aspects of it that are actually Very relatable, right? So many people who take advantage of young people and children are, people in positions of power of some kind, and groom them and manipulate them and their families and communities. And talking about these dynamics is such a crucial part of stopping that.
Andy, let me go back to you and just, I mean, I think a very important piece of this particular story is that your sister, she did go to the police. She went to the FBI. This was, decades ago, and nothing was done.
Maria, she first went to NYPD, right, and talked about what had happened to her because she was both assaulted and held on, at Jeffrey's had a place on Les Wexner's property in Ohio. And, to kind of understand the context of that, Les Wexner, who we know, was a big part of places like Victoria's Secret, The Limited, at the time, this is the 1990s, right? So, like, kind of think of the power and wealth associated with this person. And basically, when she first responds, she's trying to contact authorities there and is told, basically, we don't want to hear your report. Les Wexner runs this place, is really the reaction that she gets. He also has personal security guards there at the property, right? So it's very terrifying. And she doesn't know at that point what's happened to me. And so her mind is going to all the worst possibilities, right? And so when she finally she leaves, she's able to leave the Ohio estate, and she makes her way back to New York and talks to NYPD. They only take a report for the things that they say. Well, this happened in the city limits, some of this stuff that you're describing. But what happened to you, your sister in New Mexico, what happened to you in Ohio, those aren't within our jurisdiction. You need to call the FBI. So she does that and makes this report. And like you said, it's 1996. And, for me personally, and I know very much for her, it's one of the reasons. I mean, she fought for years. She was not quiet about this. She tried to get media interested when they weren't because of this. What went wrong? Why was this not followed up on? How could it be that people for all these years were harmed when she reported this, right? And so, I'm hoping that we get those files, right? That we get her report in this. And she actually filed a lawsuit, against the federal government for negligence in this case, because that's just a part of the institutional betrayal that I think has not been acknowledged. And I hope that with this release of information, we get some answers.
Well, and Liz, which raises a question about the enablers, the bystanders, the people that knew but said nothing. And when those emails were released about a month or so ago, or back earlier this fall, you see people in the business world and academia, in government, in media, and they're asking Jeffrey Epstein for advice, and they're flattering him. This is a man who was, found guilty of a sex crime and actually served. It was a very sweetheart deal that he got. But nonetheless, he was, a sex criminal. And there they are trying to ingratiate themselves with him. What about the enablers? What do we do about them?
That's a hard question.
Yeah.
When we look at this case, I think that we see the names of the people that were involved. And it can be hard for us to wrap our minds around these men that we hold in high esteem in our society, that they could be involved in anything like this. But strip away the names of the people that are potentially involved in this case. And this is a textbook trafficking case. There were perpetrators, there were enablers, and there were people who were preyed upon. And just because these men hold positions of power in our country, internationally, in business, in law, in government, in all of the industries that this spans, they're still criminals. They still perpetrated crimes against us. And so what they do professionally or the positions of power that they hold, we can't let ourselves get confused by that because they're perpetrators of sex crimes and they need to be held accountable. And we would be holding anyone else accountable if they didn't have these famous names. And so I think that we really just need to focus on the fact that these are perpetrators of sex crimes against girls and young women, and they need to be held accountable for what they did to us.
I mean, Annie, do we know some names? We clearly don't know all the names. Should we? Should we know everybody's name?
I mean, that's why we've been fighting for this, right? Is we believe we should. And I think that your question is a good one in that there are different levels of involvement, right? There were people who enabled, right? Maybe did not perpetrate crimes themselves, but certainly helped organize his operation or finance the operation. And then there's the people that look the other way. Like I think the complicity of silence is such an important part of this case, right? And I think about, you know, my sister Maria, who was a struggling artist who completely depended on her connections in the art world to survive financially, and yet was willing to speak out about these people. And then there were people with a lot of resources, a lot of money, a lot of power, who seemed to just be fine with looking the other way or going along because they had, you know, whatever they wanted from Epstein. And you can see in these emails and in the birthday book, it's really gross to see how very clear it is that people were aware of his behavior and yet just were wanting to ingratiate themselves, right? So I think there's different kind of outcomes we're looking for. And in part, I do think it's important that these names are released of the even like we're seeing fallout from these emails, right? People losing some of their positions of power. And I think that's right. I think that sends a strong message. Hopefully the next time someone's in a position where they're thinking something feels wrong here, you know, maybe I should say something, that they think about this case. And yes, you should.
I mean, and even going back to the case in Florida where Epstein actually did go to jail. Again, it was a sweetheart deal. The girls, the women who were sexually abused, and their lawyers didn't know nothing about the judgment, you know, the kind of light sentence, the sweetheart deal that he got. Do you still believe in our criminal justice system, that it will prevail, and that the guilty will be charged and the innocent will be set free, and perhaps the victim survivors will feel some sense of relief that justice was done?
I think the system is clearly deeply flawed, right? We see that here. And part of that relates to the way that people with power and money are able to manipulate it in the ways that most of us are not. But I am hopeful, because I also see that people are fired up about this case, have called in record numbers to their congresspeople, because I believe that is like really antithetical to, you know, what we believe in this country, right? That we should all be equal under the law. And so, you know, I am cautiously optimistic about what happens at this point. But I do think that there are also, you know, ways beyond the legal system, right? Like what we're seeing with, you know, just sort of a public, more public scrutiny and public awareness. And that's also a part of moving forward and pursuing justice.
And Liz, even beyond this Epstein case that we've been talking about, I mean, just how common is sex trafficking of girls and women? How we were talking before going on the air, and you said, well, you know, within a mile of the studio here, it's happening. I mean, it's happening in our midst. And yet, I guess it's undercover. We don't know. We go by buildings. We go by motels. We don't know what's going on inside there. What should we know?
Well, I think that these things happen because we don't talk about them. There's such a culture of silence, and that's how these things go on. And part of what we hope to do in speaking out about our case is to give other survivors the courage that they need to come out and talk about what's happened to them. Sex trafficking is incredibly prevalent. I think that we just don't understand what we're looking at. When we think about sex trafficking, we think that it happens to other people. We might think that it doesn't happen to people who are born in the United States. Mm-hmm. We might have ideas about what someone's class, race, gender, sexual identity might look like. And we need to get rid of those preconceived notions about who this happens to and who it doesn't, because it legitimately happens to everyone. I was raised in a small town in northeastern Pennsylvania. I had an intact, loving family. I had a lot of people in the community that supported me. From the outside, it looked like I had every insulating factor that would protect me from being trafficked. And yet I was still trafficked. I think that also young people might not understand the relationships that they're getting into. I see a lot of young survivors who will say to me, but he's my boyfriend, but he loves me. And it might feel that way in the moment. But when they really have a better understanding of what the dynamics are, they come to understand that, you know, they've been trafficked. And so I think that one of the ways that we move closer towards this not happening as a society is by having these uncomfortable conversations, mm-hmm. by saying, you know, I don't really understand trafficking. Let me learn more about that, by not dismissing people when they're telling you their experiences, by knowing what you're looking at when you're out in the community. What would be suspicious to you? What could be a potential sex trafficking situation? And so I think that, the more that we really, really dive into these conversations, as a society, the more understanding we have, the more able we'll be able to identify and protect other people from being trafficked.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Liz Stein joining us here on The Connection, and we are talking about sex trafficking, Jeffrey Epstein, and you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY here in Philadelphia. I'm looking at what we're bracing for, a group of Jeffrey Epstein survivors, two of you and others, released a concern that you had that once this information is released, there could be problems, including escalation of threats of safety, attempts to blame victims, incomplete or selective disclosures, efforts to divide and discredit, the politicization of our trauma. And I wonder, Annie, I'm looking at the clock here, if you could speak to those concerns and what you hope happens once we get more information.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're all bracing ourselves a little bit right now because we don't know more, you know, than the public knows here about how this information will roll out. But our concerns are based on history, right, and things that have happened previously in this case and others. And so, we put that out there because we do believe that the public is with us and supports us. And if they understand our concerns, we will, get additional support from them. There's so much information, right, that has been collected in this case. And so I think it's going to take us a little while to sort through and see, are people's individual reports in there? Are the names that someone mentioned in there, right? It's going to, I think, be a little bit of a process to figure out if the transparency that we're hoping to happen really is happening. But yes, we're already seeing some of the, some of those other kind of strategies that we talked about there, coming up in different ways. We're not going to be shocked by it. And we are, as we keep saying, right, alone, it's easy to feel fearful, but I think together we are feared, which is why we got this passed and why, we're going to keep pressing forward no matter what.
You said we are feared?
Yes.
You said that we are feared.
Yeah.
Is that a new experience for you?
It was very empowering to kind of have that.
You're
to
right.
See like, oh, wait, we do actually do have the power here, that people are with us. And so we're not going to let go of that.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us today on The Connection and for the work that you're doing and for your willingness to tell your stories, because it's so important. And Annie Farmer, thanks for joining us today on The Connection.
thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it as well. She's a licensed psychologist providing therapy and assessment for individuals and couples. Liz Stein, thank you very much as well.
Thanks for
coming in. And again, she's a survivor leader in the National Anti-Trafficking Unit, or movement, I should say. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. It airs every Friday and Sunday right here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts, and you can listen to on the WHYY app. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Adam Staniszewski has been our engineer today. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.